I'm David Pierce, and this is Protocol Source Code, brought to you by Amazon. Today on the show, I talked to Gervis Grigg, who is the global public sector CTO at Chainalysis. Chainalysis, in case you didn't know, is a firm that specializes in analyzing all kinds of different blockchains. And before Gervis worked there, he spent more than two decades at the FBI investigating financial crimes, running the FBI laboratory, and a bunch of other jobs. I wanted to have Gervis on because I wanted to talk about ransomware, which has become one of the most important stories in tech. Just recently, you have the attack on the Colonial Pipeline, which shut down a huge amount of the U.S. oil and gas system. You have JBS, the country's largest meat provider, paying $11 million in crypto to resolve its own ransomware attack. And company after company has been victimized by similar attacks. And then there's tons that we don't even hear about. So I wanted to understand why this was happening now, what governments and companies can do about it, and how this increasingly huge and lucrative industry actually works. Weirdly enough, it's surprisingly similar to the rest of the tech industry. We get into all of that in this interview, but we started by talking about crypto in general, because ransomware, the hacking industry, and crypto are all so intertwined. The first thing I asked him about was this perception among a lot of people, especially a number of years ago, that crypto is a criminal enterprise, basically, that it is an enabling thing for criminals, and that's a problem. But obviously, crypto is much more than that now. So I asked him, what is the right way to understand crypto now?
You know, there are many people that still believe that cryptocurrency is for criminals or being used by rogue states and mal actors, when the data shows that the vast majority of cryptocurrency transactions are for legitimate value transfer activity. However, it is true that criminals and rogue states do utilize cryptocurrency as yet another means for them to carry out their actions, to receive illicit payments, and to finance their operations. So there certainly is. The same can be said for cash and many other forms of value transfer.
True. Why do you think crypto gets the reputation that it does? I mean, it is certainly true that cash gets used for criminal activity, but people don't, you know, claim that cash should be regulated out of existence. Like, why has crypto gotten this sort of bad reputation?
You know, I don't know. That's a fascinating question. I think, you know, there's a common misconception that cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin are totally anonymous and untraceable. But the fact is that cryptocurrency is actually inherently transparent. And you can learn a lot about ransomware operations or money laundering and criminal activity techniques through analysis of the blockchain.
Okay. So then given that, if I'm a criminal, why on earth would I use cryptocurrency anymore? Like, to some extent, we're getting to a point where it is maybe more traceable than some other ways of moving money around. Like, why is crypto still the thing?
Because that's where the money is. Criminals always follow the money.
Interesting.
And they are been and have continued to be some of the very first adopters of new technology. We still have individuals who rob banks when they know full well that those currencies have their serial numbers recorded by the bank.
Right?
And if they get caught with those, it's going to be able to trace it back to the bank from which it was stolen. And yet they still do it. Why? Because they want money. And so criminals, like any other enterprising person, is going to follow where resources are available. And currently, right now, cryptocurrency is one of those values of choice. Of course, you know, before there was cryptocurrency, there was still ransomware and there were still criminals stealing things. This is just another form for them to try to profit from their illicit activities.
Fair enough. Is it really true that criminals are notorious early adopters of technology? Those are two things I would not necessarily have put together.
Yeah, you know, so they operate in a highly competitive, brutal market, right? How do they stay ahead of their competitor? How do they stay ahead of the law? They're not hampered by regulation, by privacy impact statements, by anything else that would inhibit their growth. And so they will do whatever it takes. You can see that when my first office was working down on the border in El Paso, we could see the narcotic traffickers adopting early technologies, cell phones, pagers, and other communication devices to try to evade law enforcement and facilitate their operations. We've now seen the emergence of drones and submarines and all kinds of other technologies that narco traffickers are using to move their product and to move it as efficiently as they can. It's no different.
So to some extent, then, the thing that people say about kind of the early days of crypto, where it's like, oh, criminals are using this, is also kind of the case for every technology everywhere. And it's just, does that come up with other stuff? I don't remember having these arguments about, you know, is the fact that criminals are using cell phones a reason not to have cell phones? But for some reason, it became a real conversation with crypto.
You know, that's an interesting comparison. Yeah, I don't know that it's a truism across all dimensions, but it has certainly been my experience to see how criminals are not afraid to embrace new technologies if it gives them a competitive edge, allows them to stay ahead of law enforcement, or at least they believe so, and to move the proceeds of their ill-gotten gains more efficiently.
Interesting.
And that's one of the appeals that they have turned to cryptocurrency because of that belief that it is anonymous, when at best it's pseudo-anonymous.
In terms of the actual currencies that are being used and stuff like this and that come up in investigations, is Bitcoin the kind of dominant player in the space like it is in most of the crypto space? Or like, are criminals migrating to Dogecoin or something else that's out there?
The data that we see indicates that the vast majority, for example, of ransomware payments are still being made in Bitcoin, while some have attempted to use other privacy coins or those that offer what they believe is an additional level of anonymity. We just haven't seen the large-scale adoption of those other coins. And why? Because liquidity is king, and the ability to receive value, transfer that value, and cash out that value is what they're after. And the more difficult it is to do that, the less incentives there are to use other forms of value transfer. I mean, heck, ransomware used to use prepaid gift cards and wire transfers, right, and other things like that, right? So they're going to migrate to those things that allow them the easiest of use and the most liquidity. And currently, right now, these mainstream coins like Bitcoin and other stable coins offer that.
But I would assume as that market gets bigger and more mature and more things become established that way, that maybe it'll spread. Like, there's nothing sort of inherently better about Bitcoin for the kinds of uses that you're looking into and talking about, right?
That's correct. Yeah, there's nothing inherently good or bad about Bitcoin itself. It just happens to be currently one of those that the majority of those ransomware users are utilizing and requesting.
Okay, so let's talk about ransomware. And this is, I'm gonna start to sound very stupid about how ransomware works very quickly. But the first thing I kind of want to do is sort of separate fact from fiction here, because it seems like on the surface that we are in, I don't know, sort of a moment of ransomware where it feels like it is becoming kind of the biggest threat in the cybersecurity world. Is that true, or have there just been a couple of high profile versions of this that are scaring people? Like, what is the real sort of state of ransomware right now?
Well, there certainly has been a number of high profile ransomware events that have captured the public's attention. But this has been quietly building in the background for some time. In fact, our data shows that ransomware is the fastest growing category of illicit use on the cryptocurrency blockchain. So you are right. It has captured the public attention of late, but it has been building. And even through the pandemic, we were seeing ransomware attacks against healthcare providers, hospitals, and others. And so you see this growing emergence of ransomware across the spectrum.
And why ransomware as opposed to sort of any of the other illicit cyber tools out there?
You know, frauds and scams make up the largest percentage of illicit use on the blockchain. However, ransomware is rapidly growing. So much of our life and businesses is wrapped up in the data of these companies. And because that data is designed to be hyper available, it also makes it potentially vulnerable. And criminals know that. They naturally gravitate to where they can make money and make money quickly. And one thing I suppose we can get into later in the broadcast, if you want, is about this whole ransomware supply chain and this cottage industry that's emerging that is facilitating and perhaps fueling the acceleration of ransomware attacks.
Yeah, let's do that now, actually, because one of the things that has amazed me the more I've learned about this is the extent to which the ransomware industry and the like regular above board software industry are basically exactly the same. Like, you replace a couple of nouns here and there, and it is incredible to me the extent to which these two industries are the same. So, but can you, at sort of a high level, explain that supply chain to me? Like, how does this industry actually sort of come together?
Sure. So let's go back in the old days. If an individual wanted to carry out a ransomware attack, they had to have a level of sophistication themselves. They would design their tool. They would design their exfil. They would try to arrange where they could store the data that they're going to steal. They had to make arrangements to figure out, what am I going to do with the payments if I get them? How am I going to obfuscate that and launder it? Well, now they can turn to a whole industry that can provide each of those services a la carte. I can go and find me an illicit cloud provider who will store my stolen data. I can go to an administrator who can provide me a series of tools that I rent from them for a price that I can use to exfil my data and to invade a system. I make arrangements with some mixers who maybe can help me launder my ill-gotten gains if I'm successful. I then make an arrangement with a cash out point that'll help me turn that cryptocurrency back into fiat. And so I end up having to pay people all along the way. And oh, by the way, you got to get that in place before you conduct your attack. So we can get into this a little bit later, but there are potentials then to move left of the event to look at campaigns that are building as individuals put these things in place before they carry out their attack. So it isn't just a ta-da, surprise ransomware attack. There's, you can see a campaign building. So this ransomware supply chain is global, and they access individuals in multiple jurisdictions to put all of this in place before the attack.
That's really interesting. Well, so basically there's the ransomware equivalent of AWS, and there's the ransomware equivalent of Stripe, and there's the ransomware equivalent of like Shopify. And so you can basically build your whole ransomware system without needing, it sounds like, much technical expertise at all anymore.
Yeah. The darknet offers individuals with very limited technical capabilities to be able to carry out a successful ransomware attack. Whereas before it was reserved for perhaps the most sophisticated and talented cyber actors, and there still are, certainly don't mean to undersell that point, but it has, as we like to say in the industry, reduced the barriers to entry, which is both scary and fascinating.
As best I can tell, there's some debate about how big this industry actually is. What's your sense of sort of the size of that industry?
You know, I think one of the best ways, or not best ways, but one of the ways to gauge that is to look at how successful these campaigns are, what the level of resources they're able to pull out of the marketplace as a result of their activities. If we look at this year, we have over $127 million we've identified so far associated with ransomware campaigns this year. And of course, that's the data only day that we can see, and there's always an inherent underreporting associated here, right? Last year, it was over 412 million. The previous year, 93 million. So certainly last year was a banner year for ransomware. And it remains to be seen what this year is going to look like. But if you look at that data and that volume trend, it's certainly a growing industry. And that begins to give you a scope of the magnitude and impact that this is having.
What about in terms of the number of players? Is this sort of a handful of companies or governments that are running a lot of this stuff? Or is there sort of a giant, like, Silicon Valley style startup ecosystem being born here?
Well, you know, thanks to that cryptocurrency is inherently transparent in blockchain analysis, we know quite a bit about how these criminals launder their funds and how these organizations come together. In 2020, we found that the majority of ransomware funds moved to cryptocurrency exchanges. That's interesting and also very helpful because this activity is relatively concentrated in just a few services, and which begins to denote a network, right? And in fact, a group of just five received more than 80% of all ransomware payments in 2020. Wow. And that's fascinating when you think of that consolidation and concentration, and that begins to show an industry and a network.
If I'm law enforcement, how do I go about trying to stop this? You sort of have to pick where along the supply chain you want to cut it off, right? Is there, have we figured out sort of where the right vector is to try and shut the system down?
I was always impressed with what General McChrystal used to say about to defeat a network, it takes a network. And so as authorities look at this growing industry of network actors, their centricity of action actually creates vulnerabilities for them and opportunities for government authorities to interdict. So as you map out this global supply chain of ransomware, it presents opportunities because the key to disrupting ransomware is disrupting the ransomware supply chain. And so as you can map out these nodes and what jurisdictions, who are the principal actors, and as that data showed, where a lot of this activity concentrates into handfuls of a few, if you can identify what those key nodes, you can begin to dismantle an organization or dismantle the service.
Got it. And what do we know about this handful? I think you said it was five players getting sort of 80% of the payments. Like, what do we know about those five players?
Yeah, these were about those cryptocurrency exchanges that received a large majority of that. Well, you know, we don't really speak about what those exchanges are. However, I think it's interesting that while, you know, some of these illicit actors, including these ransomware groups we talked about, have utilized some of these exchanges, the effective regulation, this is why it takes a whole of government approach. So regulators, law enforcement, and other officials can go after those things systematically. And I think the efforts by regulators in some of these jurisdictions to shut down or regulate these exchanges that may be dealing in illicit activity is really important in bringing stability and reliability to that ecosystem.
Okay. Yeah. And how do you think about regulation more broadly right now? Because I think, and I'm curious, both on the sort of cybersecurity side, but also on the cryptocurrency side, it seems like there is a clear sense, especially recently after, you know, Colonial Pipeline and some of the other stuff that's been happening recently, that this is a real nationwide threat that the government needs to be worrying about. And I think you could argue that they should have been worrying about it more at that level a long time ago. But it does seem like the need to do something about this is clear. But I get a sense from the few folks that I've talked to about this that the what and how of regulating and solving some of these problems is really tricky. But obviously, you're spending a lot of time talking to government folks. Like, what do you think they're thinking about right now?
Well, you're right that it is a challenge and it's complex. There's no one single silver bullet that's going to disrupt the ransomware or mitigate it. But it will take a series of actions, coordinated actions across different government agencies. So the combined power of, let's say, a regulatory and tax agency combined with a securities exchange effort to monitor some of these activities. Law enforcement will interdict particular actors. Government policy that influences jurisdictions to more fully cooperate or self-regulate those entities that are operating within their jurisdictions. It takes a whole of government to solve nationwide problems. And in this instance, because it's an international effort, it really is going to take a whole of government's solution.
Do you think that can happen quickly? I mean, I admit to not having a ton of faith in the government's ability to keep up with tech in some of that stuff. Like, is your sense that this can keep up?
You know, when you look at the impact these kinds of things are having on the everyday life of citizens in these countries, it's not just some obscure government agency who couldn't access their data for a period of time, or some manufacturer that has such a small segment of the economy that most people didn't notice. All of these, all parts of life are being impacted, from government agencies to critical infrastructure industries. And that means now everybody's got a stake in this. The higher the stakes, the more participants, the greater the energy to overcome that initial inertia that sometimes drags efforts like this. So you saw the formation of the Ransomware Task Force back announced in December, where industry and researchers and others have come together to put together potential policy recommendations of how we could work as a community. You saw the White House release a statement recently calling on the industry to work together more closely with government in a public-private partnership arrangement. I think you're going to see more of those kind of efforts, and those in the past have demonstrated the ability to be successful if you have a unified approach. And that's what it's going to take.
Hey, David here in the studio. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back for more with Gervis Greig.
In addition to a starting wage of at least $15, Amazon offers health insurance, fully paid parental leave, and skills training to aid growth. More at amazon.com/15.
This is a total sort of aside question, but a thing I have not been able to really get my head around is, how does Russia fit into this whole space?
Well, you know, as we talked about, it is a global supply chain. And while there are some ransomware actors and facilitators operating out of jurisdictions like Russia, where they hope to be able to avoid prosecution, international efforts to share information across nations can help be successful in disrupting the supply chain. But it is certainly true that there are certain jurisdictions around the world where we see larger numbers and purveyors of these attacks coming from.
But it is very much a global problem.
It is certainly a global problem, and that's why it is important to go back to that supply chain mentality, because not everything is in the same jurisdiction. In fact, if you were to look at a piece of technology that you have or a vehicle or whatever else, not all those parts are made in the same place. In fact, they're oftentimes made in multiple places and assembled. And so if we use that same kind of methodology to go after this problem, we can narrow the places in the world where they can continue to successfully operate from.
It does seem like, to your point about the energy, right, that there is momentum towards figuring this stuff out together that I certainly don't remember seeing before.
Well, and it's because it's impacting large segments of the population in the things we do for our very daily lives, right? And until a problem begins to impact people at the daily level, oftentimes it doesn't get our attention. It should, but it doesn't always. And I think not that we wish or want those kinds of things to happen. In fact, they should not. But I think these events of late and the growing prevalence of them is helping to galvanize and marshal national and international attention that properly calibrated, I think, can be quite successful.
Do you think we'll look back on the Colonial Pipeline stuff as a real inflection point in this space?
I certainly hope so. It's certainly not the only, nor the last, or the first. It is one of many. This is a long campaign and one that's going to require sustained engagement and effort. But there are natural inflection points in history. This perhaps is one of those, but one that will not be the last, but hopefully will be able to help marshal resources in a positive way.
And speaking of the Colonial Pipeline thing, what should I make of the companies like DarkSide who apologize for, you know, what they did to the Colonial Pipeline and saying, we don't want to harm anybody. We just want to take money from companies or whatever. Like these companies who are pretending or claiming they're sort of in this for the right reasons. Like, what should I make of that?
Well, I'm not really in a position to talk about that specific instance, but I've heard criminals say things like that before in my career. Didn't impress me then, doesn't impress me now.
Okay, that's about what I figured. Okay, having never been the victim of a ransomware attack, knock on wood, help me understand sort of how this process goes. I'm a company CEO, and like I wake up one morning and there's an email in my inbox that's like, we have all your stuff, give us some money. How does this typically start for a company who's the victim of this?
Unfortunately, it can happen exactly like that, where you wake up, and for some reason, your email server or your shared drives are not working. And the next thing you know, you get a call from your data ops center saying, we can't access the data and our backups are not available. And the whole infrastructure begins to cascade and fall down. And those are calls that CEOs and chief security officers dread receiving and unfortunately are happening all too often.
Okay. So then what? The answer seems to be, you know, don't pay, don't negotiate with them. But if I'm, you know, company CEO trying to deal with this stuff, the idea of not paying is sort of terrifying. So like what's step one there?
Is to begin and contact the authorities, right? The sooner time is your friend, it's also your enemy. And the longer you wait to take action and to get going, the more your options begin to narrow. So, you know, I think you heard authorities announce the other day that the position was to still not to pay ransoms. But if you do, please let us know. Let us know quickly.
Interesting.
We don't really have a position on that. I can just say that we do help both industry and government deal with the mitigation and fallout and how to conduct those investigations. But more importantly, what can they do to prepare themselves so that doesn't happen in the first place?
Where do you get involved in this process? Like, are you sort of typically coming in once this stuff is out there and has been reported, and then you're trying to figure out kind of what happened and how to undo as much of it as possible? Is that where you show up?
So in the perfect world, we're involved before, during, and after. Before, providing the training and the capabilities to raise the crypto literacy of that workforce, whether they're at a financial institution or a government agency, because learning on the fly in the middle of a crisis is not good protocol. You want to be prepared beforehand. So we've spent a lot of time on training, education, and capacity building, equipping, configuring data sets, integrating in with systems so that many of those answers can be just clicks away from the investigators or analysts, and providing that market intel and that research that could help identify potential campaigns that are building or other things of that nature. Of course, during that, all focus is on the particular event, and we can provide assistance to organizations who are right in the middle of that, and of course, in the post-investigation phase. The real focus, and I think you'll see beginning to shift and hopefully around the world, is to the pre-incident. Because the more prepared you are, the better able to deal with those crises or prevent them from happening in the first place. But we operate in all three spaces.
And what do you tell companies who are, or people even who are, or governments who are nervous about this space, haven't been victimized by ransomware yet, and are trying to figure out sort of even where to start? Like, what advice do you give them?
Yeah. So first thing is to focus on the level of crypto literacy. You know, do you have a cryptocurrency response plan, right? Do you have one? If not, spend some time looking at how to develop one. Do you have the data you would need if an incident of that nature were to occur? Have you made the arrangements? Have you trained your staff to understand and how to watch out for that? Is that part of your overall strategy of response? So we would encourage organizations, whether they're in the government or in the financial services industry, to spend some time and invest in developing cryptocurrency and ransomware mitigation strategy.
And do you find yourself having to be sort of the downer in the room, the boogeyman, being like, this is coming for everybody, you should be nervous about this? Or do you find folks you talk to are properly aware of the risks?
You know, I think we do spend a lot of time on capacity building and education and thought leadership in this space. I think there's still more to be done there to raise awareness about the impact that these threats are having, as well as the opportunity that, you know, countering that first narrative that we began with, that, well, cryptocurrency is anonymous and I can't do anything about it. And once it's gone, it can never be gotten back. Just simply not the case in every instance. And if you have the right data, the tools, and you act quickly, there are things that can be done. And so I think dispelling and perhaps giving reassurances that that narrative is just not the case, and that there are things you can do. You don't have to be a victim, and you can prepare.
Okay. Yeah. And it's, I mean, sort of the same across the board with all of the hacking stuff. I think one thing people are slowly learning is that it is possible to prepare yourself. You can never be fully prepared, but it's like putting the locks on your door, right? Like, it won't solve all problems, but it will solve a lot of your problems. And that even not enough companies and governments and people have done that. And it feels like that's one thing I hope we get to very quickly.
Agree. You know, it's funny when you do postmortems on these incidents, it doesn't explain every scenario, but simply, you know, is your company updating, protecting, and backing up your information, right? So if you lose access to your information, when was your last backup? Where is it stored and how easy is it to be accessed? Is it also protected, or is it going to become vulnerable to the same, right? Mm. So if you store your backup in the same place where your live is, if one goes down, the other does. Have you trained your staff? Do you have an ongoing training and refresher program? What's your network monitoring looking like? You know, are you watching for making sure you're not becoming a victim of crypto jacking or illicit crypto mining, actually stealing your own power to do crypto mining? And employing those best practices for your credential management and making sure that you're updating and keeping your leadership and your staff aware of your crypto response strategy. I mean, those are basic cyber hygiene things that you will hear about in any good cyber forum, and yet they're oftentimes neglected in part or in whole in some parts of our environments. And criminals look for unlocked doors.
Right.
And the same thing's true in the cyber world.
Right. Absolutely. And how quickly is the ransomware industry itself changing? I mean, obviously, it has been, like you said, doing this for a long time, really has sort of exploded both in the financial impact and in sort of public consciousness over the last 12 months. Is the industry itself going to shift a bunch as it becomes more well-known and the ways to stop it become more well-known? Like, how cat and mouse is this game going to be, do you think?
Yeah, it will be cat and mouse. I mean, if we look at any other emerging threat or trend, it is a cat and mouse. One side makes a change, the other side makes a response. So we'll see that. I mean, the first generation of ransomware was, I come in, I lock up your data, and I demand a payment. Well, now come in, I lock up your data, I demand a payment, but I also maybe steal your data and resell it to someone else and get a double profit. And then, of course, the next evolution of that is I come in, I lock up your data, I demand a payment, I steal your data, I sell it to someone else, and then I also threaten you to DDoS you if you don't pay me. Mm-hmm. So you just see this escalation and this variation. What will that next inflection point look like? Well, it's interesting to postulate. I'm not sure what that's going to be, but something will happen and it will evolve.
Do you think it'll continue to be true that kind of following the money is going to be the most useful way to find this stuff? Like, it does seem like so far. Some of the maps you guys have built about how these systems work just through blockchain transactions is pretty remarkable. Is that going to continue to be the strategy?
I believe it will. Okay. In my days at the Bureau, following the money, you always found the people responsible, right? When you follow the money, you find the actors responsible. Whether that's true in a white collar case or healthcare fraud, it wasn't the billing clerk that was responsible, right? He or she was submitting those bills on behalf of the provider who was bilking the system. Because when you follow the money, it didn't all go to the billing clerk, right? It went to the illicit provider. Same thing is true here. You follow the money, you'll find the people responsible. Financial analysis is one of the key ways to disrupt this. And the interesting thing about the blockchain and cryptocurrency, it is the unifying data across all of these. So how are you paying your illicit cloud provider in cryptocurrency? How are you paying your mixer in cryptocurrency? How are you paying your cash out point in cryptocurrency? What about the guy who sold you all of the ransomware tools in cryptocurrency? So blockchain analysis is a unique type of data set that runs across all of the supply chain actors and gives you that insight that other traditional forms of fiat maybe don't always and obfuscates who's involved.
Does that mean we're due in a decade for a totally anonymous version of cryptocurrency that makes this process much harder? Like, is that one version of the cat and mouse game here? Is they keep trying to find more and more anonymous cryptocurrencies?
It's always possible. But we go back to the thing we talked about there at the beginning. At the end of the day, you want liquidity, right? Mm. So you don't rob banks and take their post-its because they're not right. worth much and you can't sell them. I mean, they're worth something to somebody. So you're going to take what's valuable. And right. so while it's always possible that some of these privacy coins could rise in popularity and frequency, but they're only going to if they are capable of being fungible and liquid. And we've seen great efforts across the world in some of these exchanges and regulators in driving down the illicit use of cryptocurrencies by a proper regulation and making sure that these exchanges are doing a good job at helping prevent ransomware cash outs on their platforms by helping to regulate and do a better job at knowing their customers and looking at what those kinds of transactions involve. So I think we'll see increased efforts in that arena, and that may have a mitigating impact. But what we'll see in the future, it's hard to predict at this pivot point.
Last question on that front, and then I will let you go. What do you see on the cryptocurrency regulation radar coming? Because I think this stuff has gotten big and important, both as an asset class and as a currency, I think much faster than anyone would have guessed and has kind of outstripped the regulatory environment. What do you see coming in terms of how the government regulates crypto, both in the US and elsewhere?
I think we will see some changes in the regulatory regimes and environments. You can't have trillions of dollars move onto the marketplace and not have regulation follow, which both provides safety and security to the investors and more regulation and helps to manage some of the inherent volatility that comes with unregulated market spaces. On the other hand, I think you will also see calls by users of these cryptocurrencies for appropriate regulation, that it not be overreaching. You know, the World Bank a few years ago said that as much as 31% of the world's population remains unbanked, meaning they don't have relationships with financial institutions. Many are seeing cryptocurrency as another way to be able to provide low-cost, secure value transfers methodologies. And especially as the growth of the internet and the mobility of individuals using mobile phones and other devices, I think we will continue to see dramatic growth in cryptocurrency transaction volume and market capitalization. And with that, appropriate regulation will help provide a level of stability to it. So I think we will see reasonable regulations, and I don't think it will be uniform. I think we'll see some countries move further, some less so. But hopefully in the balance, we will get a more stable ecosystem that will further make it difficult for criminals to leverage this as a means to move their illicit funds.
Fair enough. All right. Well, Gervas, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
Thanks again to Gervas for being here, and thank you so much for listening. As always, you can subscribe to Source Code anywhere you get podcasts. Please rate us if you can, and sign up to get the Source Code email newsletter every day at protocol.com/newsletters. Have a great one. We'll talk to you soon.
An independent study found Amazon's $15 starting wage increased pay for non-Amazon workers in the same area. More on the impact of Amazon's investments in their employees at amazon.com/15.